entire Israeli police force is hunting us down, right? Natasha was not amused. She set down the small toothbrush she was using to clean the outside of the scroll and looked Bennett in the eye.
We only get one shot at this, you know. One wrong move, and this thing will turn to chalk dust faster than you can blink, okay?
I'm sorry, he said. I'm just worried about Aaron, for starters.
Me too, said Natasha, accepting his apology. I'm going as fast as I can.
I know, he said, rifling through the cabinets to find something to eat.
Third door on your right, Natasha said as she focused again on her work.
Bennett opened the cupboard door and found a box of granola.
Thanks. Don't mention it, but there's no milk.
No milk?
No. Well, there was, but it had gone bad. I poured it out.
His stomach growled.
There are some eggs in the fridge, Natasha added.
Any bacon? He asked, pulling the refrigerator door open.
Very funny, said Natasha. You're in Israel, remember? Not a big market for bacon here, you know?
Sorry, he said, shaking his head. He couldn't let the stress eat him alive. There was too much at stake. How about if I make us some fried eggs and toast? Natasha looked up.
That'd be nice, thanks.
No problem, he said, pulling out pans and firing up the stove. So, how much more time do you think you'll need?
You'd better pray that I'm faster than Baker was, Natasha replied.
Who?
Dr. H. Wright Baker.
Who's that?
He was a professor of mechanical engineering at the University of Manchester Institute of Science and Technology in England. He was the one who finally came up with the solution to open the copper scroll without destroying it.
Oh, right, said Bennett, remembering Dr. Barak's words in the Jordan Archaeological Museum. It took 3 years or something.
Four.
Bennett turned and looked back at Natasha. You're right. I do hope you're faster than Baker. Why did it take so long to open the copper scroll anyway?
It didn't, she explained, still hard at work.
What took so long was figuring out how to open it.
When they actually got around to doing it, it didn't take long at all. Once they had a plan, Baker and his team cleaned away as much of the external oxidation as they could. Then they x-rayed the scroll to see where the letters were positioned inside. After that, they built a high-speed circular saw like something a jeweler would use to cut diamonds, and they sliced the scroll into 23 segments.
Bennett remembered the copper segments in the flimsy display cases in the museum.
And they did this all the while attempting to cut only between the various columns of text so as to avoid destroying any of the letters, Natasha said.
A few minutes later, Bennett walked over to the table and set down two plates of food. How long would it take to build a saw like that? He asked.
We already did it, she replied.
What are you talking about?
We already built one, Natasha said. It's in my grandfather's office in Jerusalem. Don't forget, he was absolutely sure we were going to find the key scroll, so he had the engineers at the museum make one for him. There's just one problem.
What's that? Asked Bennett.
We can't go back to his office without getting caught.
Good point, he said, wondering again if any of this had been worth it. So now what do we do?
I have an idea.
She smiled.
You'll see.
Chapter 48. Friday, January 16th, 11 a.m., White House Situation Room. The President will see you now, Mr. Costello. Costello thanked the President's military assistant and waited for a Marine guard to enter the passcode into the Situation Room. Once inside, he shook Bob Corsetti's hand and was directed to take a seat beside Indira Rajiv. Already seated were President McPherson, Vice President Bill Oakes, Homeland Security Secretary Lee James, CIA Director Jack Mitchell, Secretary of State Nicholas Warner, and National Security Advisor Marsha Kirkpatrick.
Good morning, Mr. President.
Good morning, Ken. Thanks for getting back here so quickly. I want to talk about Lucente and the UN in a moment, but first, I understand we have a serious situation developing in Israel?
We do, Mr. President, Costello confirmed.
I've just read the memo you sent to Marsha and the update you emailed from the plane on the way home, McPherson continued. But just to clarify, Ken, most of this is based on your phone call with John?
Several calls, actually, but yes, Mr. President, that is correct.
So John actually told you that the men found dead in Mordecai's house were killed by Aaron?
In self-defense, sir.
He said that himself?
He did, sir.
Those exact words?
Yes, sir.
Self-defense?
Yes, sir.
What about the four people the Israelis found dead in the cafe in the Jewish quarter?
It didn't come up, sir.
And you didn't ask?
No, sir. But the Israelis are saying those three, the cafe owners and their accountant, were killed by a different gun, a sniper rifle, I believe.
Not a Beretta.
Correct, sir.
And John told you he couldn't turn himself in because he fears a penetration of Daron's inner circle?
Costello nodded. Yes, sir.
Didn't he expect you would have to pass that on to me?
I wouldn't presume to know exactly what John's thinking at the moment, sir, but yes, I think that's a pretty safe assumption. He certainly knows how this office works.
Have you talked to anyone in the Israeli government since you spoke to John?
No, sir. I thought it best to bring this to Ms. Kirkpatrick's attention first and then to yours.
McPherson nodded and turned to CIA Director Jack Mitchell. What do you make of all this, Jack?
Mr. President, I'm tempted to say John's gone off the deep end this time, said Mitchell, whose own history with Bennett was long and complicated. But in this case, there is a lot of circumstantial evidence to suggest some sort of conspiracy is unfolding.
Such as?
There's the bombing at the Willard that resulted in Dr. Murray's death. There's the car bombing in L.A. that took Barry Jasper's life. There's Eli Mordecai's assassination to account for, the unsolved mystery of Lionel Mansfield's death in London, and now the murder of Dr. Barak in Jerusalem. I never thought of archaeology as such a dangerous profession, but it's clear that somebody's on a killing spree.
But how can you be sure that all those deaths are linked? The president asked.
Because every one of those men was working on a project for Prime Minister Daron.
The president gave Mitchell a hard look.
What project?
Mitchell didn't blink.
Daron put together a team of archaeologists to look into the possibility of recovering Israel's ancient temple treasures and rebuilding the temple.
And you knew about this? McPherson demanded.
Yes, sir.
Who else knew?
Every eye in the room volleyed back to the DCI.
Mitchell opened a folder and handed out a single sheet stamped Top Secret Eyes Only to everyone in the room, beginning with the president.
Costello did a double take when he got his copy. Listed, of course, were the names of the Israeli Prime Minister and his closest advisors. Dr. Yossi Barak's name was also there, as was Natasha Barak's, along with Dr. Barry Jaspers, Dr. Lionel Mansfield, Dr. George Murray of the Smithsonian, his literary agent, and each of the men's wives. But there were other names on the list as well. Dr. Larry McKenzie, Director, National Security Agency. Dr. Christopher Watkins, Director of Analysis, NSA. Colonel Tanya Freeling, Hebrew Analyst, NSA. Dr. John Mitchell, Director of Central Intelligence. Dr. Alex Valletta, DDI CIA. Daniel J. Tracker, DDO CIA. Dr. Indira Rajiv, Director, Namistan Desk, CIA.
Costello looked to the president. The shock in McPherson's eyes mirrored the shock in his own.
Indira, what is this? Asked the president. You knew about Daron's temple project, too?
I did, sir.
How?
Electronic intercepts, Mitchell explained.
What are you talking about? Asked the president.
Sir, last fall, after Bennett gave you a copy of Dr. Mordecai's Ezekiel option memo, I asked NSA to wiretap Mordecai's phones and pay extra close attention to Daron and his inner circle.
Why? McPherson wanted to know.
Vice President Oakes took a crack at that.
Let me guess, Jack, you wanted to know where Mordecai was getting his information.
In part, of course, Mitchell conceded. Mordecai was projecting events none of us in the agency had foreseen, and every day that went by, he was being proven right. I found that extraordinary, and I found it hard to believe the Bible was the source of his prescience. I was sure he had other sources, and I wanted to track them down and tap them myself.
But that wasn't all? The Vice President asked.
No, it wasn't, said Mitchell. I also needed to know how Prime Minister Daron and his team were using Mordecai's information.
And you were afraid they might strike at Russia and Iran first? Asked Kirkpatrick.
Weren't we all? Asked Mitchell.
and we were right to be concerned. Drone almost did launch first.
But it was Mordecai who stopped him, McPherson noted.
It was a number of factors, Mr. President, said Mitchell. But the point is, I needed to know precisely what was happening in Israel, and who was influencing whom, and what might happen next, so that I could brief you and the rest of the NSC as accurately as possible. Given the circumstances, I would do it again. You would tap the phones of the Israeli Prime Minister, the head of Mossad, and the former head of Mossad without my authorization? McPherson asked.
Yes, sir. Given the uniquely dangerous situation we were in, on the brink of a worldwide nuclear war.
I will deal with all that in a moment, but this still doesn't explain how you knew about Daron's temple project.
That's true, Mr. President, Mitchell said, but I'll explain. The truth of the matter is there was so much happening in the days and weeks after the firestorm that I never called Larry McKenzie at NSA to shut the operation down.
You're saying we just kept gathering intel on Eli and Daron? Asked the VP.
Yes, sir. And then?
And then, Mitchell continued, about a month ago, Larry and his team, Chris and Tanya, came over to Langley and told us what they had.
Why didn't you shut it down right then? Asked McPherson.
I'll admit, said Mitchell, by then I was curious. Indira here reminded me about rumors that had been floating around the agency for years, that two CIA officers had died back in the 90s trying to track down the temple treasures and the Ark. And then Larry and his team began picking up strange chatter out of Italy, Kuwait, and Iraq about something called Operation Black Box, but we didn't know what that was. I thought they might be connected, but so much else was happening I couldn't give it much time.
The president leaned in toward Mitchell and lowered his voice.
When George Murray was killed, why didn't you say anything?
The DCI said nothing.
When Barry Jaspers was killed, why didn't you say something to me then?
I don't know, Mr. President. It was just a working theory, one of many. I didn't think it was ready to bring to your level just yet.
Costello watched the president lean back in his chair, mulling it over. After a moment, McPherson said,
You mentioned Operation Black Box. What is it?
We don't know at this point, sir, admitted Mitchell. But one possibility is it's an operation to take out the people involved with Prime Minister Daron's project. That's why I think it's just possible that Bennett may be right. Someone may be after him.
The president turned to his Homeland Security secretary.
What about you, Lee? You buy it?
No, I don't buy it, Mr. President, James said without hesitation. With all due respect to Jack here, I just can't see anyone on Daron's team betraying him like that.
Can't or won't? Asked Mitchell.
Costello watched James turn to the DCI. He expected him to fire back hard, but James was too much of a gentleman for that.
Jack, be serious, James said. You really think someone in David Daron's office is feeding inside intel to Israel's enemies? You think someone inside Daron's office is trying to keep Daron from rebuilding the temple? There's no evidence of that.
Except for the list of dead bodies, replied Mitchell, and the fact that someone does seem to be tracking John and Aaron Bennett.
McPherson looked back down at the names typed single-spaced on CIA letterhead.
There's another possibility here, he said. If there is a mole, it's possible that it's not in Daron's office at all, he said to no one in particular. Theoretically, it could be one of our own.
The room grew icy and still. Mitchell shifted in his seat.
Yes, sir, the DCI said at last. I guess it could.
McPherson turned to his chief of staff.
Bob, get the Attorney General and the Director of the FBI on the phone. I want lie detector tests given to every American on this list by the close of business tomorrow. I want to know who leaked this thing, and if anyone in my government is involved, I promise you, heads will roll.
Chapter 49 Saturday, January 17th, 8:35 a.m., Tiberias, Israel. Natasha led Bennett into the basement. They flicked on some lights and then entered a storage room, and there, in the far corner, was a strange machine with all kinds of wires and tubes running in and out of it.
What is that? Bennett asked as his eyes adjusted to the harshness of the fluorescent bulbs overhead.
A laser, Natasha said as she went over and turned it on.
It's huge.
It's industrial strength, top of the line. But why is it so big?
Copper is one of the toughest metals to cut with a laser, said Natasha. It's highly reflective and highly conducive, meaning it can absorb a truckload of heat without melting or cracking, both of which slow down the cutting process. Typically, the less copper an alloy contains, the faster it will cut, but in this case, we're dealing with extremely pure copper, which means we needed a laser that could operate at 400 watts rather than the typical 100 to 250 watts. The problem is, 400 watts is a whole lot of energy and creates a whole lot of heat. Making sure the laser and the scroll are stable and keeping the laser well cooled and ventilated takes a bit of space.
I guess so, said Bennett. And you just happen to have one lying around?
I told you already, said Natasha. My grandfather and I have been making preparations for this for almost 3 months.
Right, but I thought that's why he had the special saw built at the museum.
He did. Then why this?
It was my idea, said Natasha.
I thought I'd play around with it a bit and see if it would work. I asked Miriam if she would get me one, and she agreed.
Did you tell her why you needed it?
Not exactly.
Did you tell her about the key scroll?
Of course not. I just said I needed it for an upcoming project. She said yes. End of story.
Did your grandfather know about it?
No, I never told him.
Why not?
You met him, said Natasha. He was old-fashioned. He had a certain way of doing things, and that was that. He was in the room when Dr. Baker opened the copper scroll in Manchester in 1956. He saw how it was done, so he decided that's how it should be done. He wasn't exactly open to new ideas about the latest technology.
Not big into lasers, huh? Asked Bennett. Natasha shook her head.
He never even saw Star Wars.
Ken Costello kept tossing and turning. It was only 2 a.m. in Washington, but his body was still on Israel time, and there it was 9 in the morning. He was glad to finally be back in his own bed after several wrenching days in Israel, back with his wife, whose pregnancy was just beginning to show. But as she slept soundly, he couldn't sleep at all. He kept replaying the meeting in the Situation Room over and over again in his mind. How in the world could Mitchell have authorized wiretaps and other electronic surveillance on Israel's top leaders? And how could he have kept all that from the president? Costello could only imagine the political firestorm that would erupt if such information leaked out. Any leverage McPherson might have over Daron to keep the temple from being built would fly right out the window. But the more he thought about it, the more he realized that it wasn't shock he was feeling, so much as anger. Had someone at the CIA or NSA leaked Daron's temple project? To whom? For what reason? And as much as he wished it weren't true, Costello couldn't shake the feeling that it was. There was no shortage of officials in the American intelligence community opposed to Israel's plans to rebuild their ancient temple in Jerusalem. Some opposed the idea for geopolitical reasons, fearing it could trigger another regional war or impede the peace process. Others opposed it on ideological grounds, convinced as they were that religious fundamentalism was at the root of most of the world's conflicts, and thus suspicious, if not outright hostile, to those who held strong spiritual convictions. As for himself, Costello didn't know where he stood. He and Tracy had quietly been studying end times prophecy for weeks, drawing much of their information from Eli Mordecai's website, as did millions of other curious souls. Though he could never admit it at work, he found himself intrigued by the possibility that major prophecies were coming true in their lifetime, and that even bigger ones could be on the way. Mordecai had taught that the War of Gog and Magog was just the beginning. The temple would be built next, he explained, whether world leaders wanted it to be or not, and the rapture could happen at any moment, he warned, followed by the rise of the Antichrist and then the tribulation. Is that what was really about to happen? In some ways it seemed so ludicrous, yet so much of what Mordecai had predicted had already come true. What if the old man was right about the rest, too? And then there was the big question. When Jesus came, would Costello be allowed to meet him in the air? Or was he in danger of being lost? Costello wondered. And what about Tracy? Would they go to heaven together, or suffer 7 years of hell on earth, if they even made it that long? Such were the questions that weighed on him in these days, but he could not make up his mind. As much as he wanted to, he couldn't seem to take the leap of faith required to become a true, devoted follower of Christ. The notion of being born again was just a little too much for him, and yet the words of the Bible seemed to haunt him.
He who has the Son has eternal life. He who does not have the Son of God does not have the life. Now is the day of salvation. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come into him, and will dine with him, and he with me. Suddenly, Costello heard someone pounding downstairs. The doorbell rang. It wasn't spiritual, it wasn't metaphoric. There was actually someone at the front door. Startled, he put on his glasses and ran downstairs in his boxer shorts and a t-shirt. He peered through the curtains. It was a courier. At this hour, he opened the door. The courier was a tall black man in a large blue parka.
"Are you Mr. Kenneth Costello?"
"I am."
"You ordered a rush job from the Library of Congress?"
"I did."
"Sorry it's so late, but I got here as fast as I could," said the man. "Sign here."
Costello scribbled his name, took the large sealed envelope, and closed the door. Next, he went into the kitchen, flicked on some lights, turned on the coffee pot, and ripped open the package. Inside was a note from the chief librarian. As requested, along with a first edition of the book that Costello had a hunch was going to occupy the rest of his day. He stared at the cover. The Treasure of the Copper Scroll. The opening and decipherment of the most mysterious of the Dead Sea Scrolls, a unique inventory of buried treasure, by John Marco Allegro. Costello opened the book to the title page and found it copyrighted in 1960, then began slowly flipping through its pages, trying to get a brief overview before reading it cover to cover. On page 33, he came across Allegro's translation of the now notorious Copper Scroll. Item 1. In the fortress, which is in the Vale of Achor, 40 cubits under the steps entering to the east, a money chest and its contents, a weight of 17 talents. Item 2. In the sepulchral monument, in the third course of stones, light bars of gold. Item 3. In the great cistern, which is in the court of peristyle, in the plaster of its floor, concealed in a hole in front of the upper opening, 900 talents. And so it went for page after page. Item 47. In the reservoir, which is in Beth Kerem, 10 cubits on its left as you enter, 62 talents of silver. Item 48. In the vat of the olive press, in its western side, a plug stone of 2 cubits, it is the opening, 300 talents of gold and 10 serving vessels. Costello had never read anything like it, nor had he ever planned to, but now people were apparently being killed and he had to know more. He skipped ahead to chapter 3, The Treasure. One passage in particular caught his eye. Tales of buried treasure are to be found in any folklore, and Jewish literature has them in full measure, wrote Allegro, who went on to summarize some of the more popular versions from the Bible, as well as from extra-biblical literature, like the second book of Maccabees, which said that the prophet Jeremiah once commanded the tabernacle and the ark to accompany him to Mount Nebo on the shores of the Dead Sea. There he found a cave in which he placed the tabernacle, the ark, and the incense altar, and then sealed its entrance. Allegro explained. Even the prophet's followers did not know its whereabouts, but he promised that it would be revealed when God shall gather his people together again and receive them unto his mercy. Most of these traditions look to the time when the Messiah would restore the glory and the temple and its treasures, Allegro concluded, adding that all such stories bear the obvious marks of fiction, either in the manner and place of concealment or in the nature of the treasure concerned. But what intrigued Costello most was that Allegro explained that he believed the Copper Scroll was no legend. He believed it was real and fully expected the treasures to one day be found.
Is that what John and Aaron are really doing? Hunting for the temple treasures and the Ark of the Covenant?
Whatever they were doing, someone was trying to kill them before they succeeded. Someone was killing everyone connected to the Copper Scroll, and for all Costello knew, it might actually be someone in his own government. Chapter 50. Saturday, January 17th, 2:49 a.m., McLean, Virginia. It was almost 3 a.m. when Rajiv finally got home. She quietly closed and locked the front door behind her, then checked on her husband. He was sound asleep. Next, she tiptoed into her closet, pulled out a small carry-on suitcase, and took it back down to the kitchen of their Tyson's Corner townhouse. There was no time to pack clothes, but she wouldn't need them anyway. With the money she was being paid, she could buy anything she wanted when she reached her destination. Rajiv then crawled under the sink, pulled up the linoleum, and pried away two wooden panels. Inside was a steel box, sealed shut with a combination lock.
Inside the box were six fake passports, six different credit cards, each tied to the aliases on the passports, and $9,000 in cash, all in well-worn $20 and $50 bills. She stuffed it all in the suitcase, zipped it up, and replaced the wood panels under the sink. Then she took one last look around at a home she had loved but always known she'd one day flee. She would actually miss her husband, and suddenly realized. He had been better to her than she had expected. Indeed, he had turned out to be a very sweet man, attentive, doting, the kind of man she might have enjoyed growing old with, if she had ever planned to stay married to begin with. It had never dawned on Peter Mohan Rajiv that his arranged marriage to Indira Visalu Paraji had been a sham from the beginning, and in a way she loved him for that. But it was over now. She hoped it would not destroy him, but she feared it would. Rajiv jumped into her BMW Z4 and took off. Then came the hard part. Which airport, which alias, and which getaway city? Dulles and Reagan National were out. It was too likely she'd run into someone she knew. The same was true with BWI. Even JFK was risky. She got on the Beltway and headed north to 95. She could be in Boston in 8 hours, 9 at the most, and in London by morning. It was a gamble, but it was the only chance she had. Chapter 51. Saturday, January 17th, 3:13 p.m., Tiberias, Israel. Aaron, can you hear me? She could hear the words. She knew it was John. She was just having trouble actually getting her eyes open. She found his hand and squeezed it gently, and a moment later, she was looking into his beautiful green eyes. Hey, welcome back, she heard her husband say. She smiled and tried to speak. You need some water? He asked, apparently not sure if he had heard her right. Aaron nodded, almost imperceptibly, and John quickly poured her a glass from the carafe on the bedside table. He held her head up as she took a few sips and then gently lowered her head back onto the pillow. You had me worried for a while there, he said as his eyes filled with tears. You gotta stop doing that to me. I'm sorry, Aaron whispered back. It's okay, I forgive you, he replied. Just don't let it happen again. He put another pillow under her head to prop her up a bit. How about some good news, he asked. Aaron nodded eagerly. It's pretty big, he said, smiling. You might want to lie down for this. She loved to see those crinkles form around his eyes. I found the key scroll. Aaron gasped. You're kidding, she whispered as she tried to sit up. I'm not, he replied, his eyes telling the story. In the tunnel? She asked. Absolutely, he confirmed, right where Donovan thought it was all the time. Unfortunately, I found him as well. His bones, at least. Harkins, too. It was pretty grim. How did they die? She asked of the men who had once been her colleagues. Landmine, snipers. I doubt they even knew what hit them. Aaron winced and squeezed his hand again. It was amazing they hadn't been killed as well. There was a knock at the bedroom door. Come in, Bennett replied. Natasha entered the room. She pulled up a chair next to the bed, a yellow legal pad and a pen in her hands. You done? Bennett asked, clearly surprised to see her. Yes, she said, her face showing the relief. I'd just finished. It went faster than I'd expected. It's done? Asked Aaron, her voice still barely a whisper. Can we see it? Right now? Asked Natasha. No, next week, Aaron quipped. Good to see you've still got a sense of humor, Natasha noted. I'll show it to you in a moment. First, let me read you what it says. There was an electricity of anticipation in the room as Natasha flipped back through her notes, cleared her throat, and started to read. The word of the Lord came to me. Son of man, this is what the Sovereign Lord says to the land of Israel. The end. The end is now upon you, and I will unleash my anger against you. I will judge you according to your conduct and repay you for all your detestable practices. I will not look upon you with pity or spare you. Then you will know that I am the Lord. This is what the Sovereign Lord says. Disaster, an unheard-of disaster is coming. Doom has come upon you who dwell in the land. Outside is the sword, inside are the plague and the famine. All who survive and escape will be in the mountains. Their silver and gold will not be able to save them in the day of the Lord's wrath.
See, I am setting before you today a blessing and a curse. The blessing, if you obey the commands of the Lord your God that I am giving you today. The curse, if you disobey the commands of the Lord your God, and turn from the way that I command you today by following other gods, which you have not known. When the Lord your God has brought you into the land you are entering to possess, you are to proclaim the blessings and the curses, as you know.
That's it? Asked Bennett.
That's everything, said Natasha.
I don't understand, he continued. The copper scroll pointed toward 64 different locations. Line 64 said that the key scroll would decode it all and lead us to the treasure. So what's this? Are we even sure this is the right scroll?
What are the chances of you finding anything in those tunnels? 1,000,000 to 1? Asked Natasha. And what are the chances of you finding a scroll also engraved on copper if it's not connected to the first copper scroll? 1,000,000,000 to 1?
But what good is it? Bennett countered. It doesn't tell us anything.
Maybe it does, said Natasha. Look at line 5. The end is now upon you. See, that's interesting, said Natasha, now up and pacing about the room. That's certainly consistent with the thinking of the Essenes. They definitely believed the end was upon them.
So what? Bennett complained. That doesn't mean that...
Bennett stopped in mid-sentence. Aaron was whispering something.
Read a few lines down, she said. Something about silver and gold.
Bennett looked at Natasha, who scanned the text again and read the lines aloud.
Their silver and gold will not be able to save them in the day of the Lord's wrath. You think that could refer to the temple treasures? Natasha asked.
Aaron nodded.
She may be right, said Natasha, looking at Bennett.
Maybe, he said, but Aaron, sweetheart, that's pretty thin evidence, you've got to admit, especially compared to the copper scroll.
You said it yourself, Natasha. The first one lists over 3,000 talents of silver, almost 1,300 talents of gold, more than 65 gold bars, and some 600 silver pitchers, all of which are said to contain silver, and over 600 other vessels made of silver and gold. And you said the key scroll would explain it all.
Maybe it does, said Aaron.
What do you mean? Asked Bennett.
Maybe it does, and we're just not seeing it clearly.
How so?
It's in the mountains. What is? The treasure. Read it again. The silver and gold won't save them, but...
Again, Bennett and Natasha looked back at the text. All who survive and escape will be in the mountains. Their silver and gold will not be able to save them in the day of the Lord's wrath.
Was she right? Bennett wondered.
Was the treasure hidden in the mountains? And if so, which ones?
Chapter 52, Saturday, January 17th, 3:46 p.m., Tiberias, Israel.
How many mountains are there in Israel? Bennett asked.
Natasha looked at him with a pained expression.
Where do you want to start? There's the Mount of Olives, Mount Hermon, Mount Zion, of course, Masada.
Masada, Bennett broke in. Could that be it?
That bit about surviving and escaping in the mountains. Masada is a fortress, right?
Masada towered some 1,500 feet over the Dead Sea. It was the site where the last band of Jewish rebels, more than 1,000 men, women, and children, held off the Roman army for 4 years as the Romans sought to conquer every square inch of the Holy Land for their Caesar and themselves. Was it possible the Jews had taken the second temple treasures there? Had that been why the Romans were so determined to seize Masada?
When the Roman forces finally stormed the mountaintop fortress, they found that the entire band of Jewish insurgents had already committed suicide. Could they have killed themselves to keep the Romans from ever finding the gold and silver of their beloved temple? Natasha suddenly ran out of the room without saying a word. Bennett and Aaron just looked at each other, perplexed. But a moment later, Natasha was back with her laptop. She logged onto Miriam's wireless internet system and pulled up a Hebrew Bible site. Then she typed in the text from their mystery scroll and ran a search.
What is it? Asked Bennett. What are you looking for?
The language of this scroll is so curious, Natasha explained. I'm wondering if...
She leaned toward her computer screen.
I knew it, she said at last.
Knew what? Asked Bennett.
The first section is scripture, she exclaimed. In fact, it's an excerpt from Ezekiel chapter 7.
Natasha punched some keys and ran another search.
The next portion is from the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 11. Does either book mention Masada? Asked Aaron. That's what I'm checking right now, said Natasha, as her fingers flew across the keyboard. And?
Natasha looked disappointed.
Masada isn't mentioned in either Ezekiel or Deuteronomy, she sighed.
Check the rest of the Bible, Bennett suggested.
Natasha did, but came up with nothing.
Disappointment settled over the room.
What about the other mountains you mentioned? Asked Bennett.
I don't see how that helps us, said Natasha. If Aaron's right, if the treasure is buried in the mountains, then there must be a clue that we're missing.
Again, she went to work on the computer as Bennett and Aaron waited impatiently.
That's strange, she said after a moment.
What's that?
The passage from Deuteronomy. It's not complete.
What do you mean?
I mean it begins in chapter 11, verse 26, and runs through the first phrase of verse 30. But in between, it's missing several key words and phrases.
Again, Natasha bolted out of the room.
Where are you going?
Bennett shouted after her.
Hold on, I'll be right back,
Natasha yelled back. A minute later, she was back with Miriam's personal laptop. She set the two computers side by side. On one, she pulled up a portion of the scroll text. When the Lord your God has brought you into the land you are entering to possess, you are to proclaim the blessings and the curses, as you know. On the other, she pulled up Deuteronomy chapter 11, verses 29 and 30. When the Lord your God has brought you into the land you are entering to possess, you are to proclaim on Mount Gerizim the blessings, and on Mount Ebal the curses. As you know, these mountains are across the Jordan, west of the road, toward the setting sun, near the great trees of Morah, in the territory of those Canaanites living in the Arabah, in the vicinity of Gilgal. Natasha pointed to the English text on the first screen, and then to her notes on the second.
See where the scroll's author writes, you are to proclaim, then there's an extra space, the blessings and, then there's another extra space, the curses, then another extra space, then the phrase, as you know.
The Bennetts nodded.
Now look at the actual biblical text, said Natasha. The full sentence should read, you are to proclaim on Mount Gerizim the blessings and on Mount Ebal the curses. But in the scroll version, the words on Mount Gerizim and on Mount Ebal are missing from the text.
That is odd, said Bennett, studying the passage more closely.
Then Aaron said, wait a minute, Gerizim and Ebal, those are mentioned in the copper scroll.
They are? Asked Bennett, surprised but pleased that Aaron was thinking clearly enough to recall such an obscure detail. Natasha nodded and looked impressed.
Somebody was doing her homework. You studied the translation my grandfather gave you and John back at the Jordan Archaeological Museum in Amman, didn't you?
Aaron nodded.
Gerizim and Ebal are two mountains north of Jerusalem and due west of where we just discovered the key scroll, Natasha said. Line 61 of the copper scroll refers directly to Mount Gerizim.
She pulled up a digital image of the copper scroll on one laptop screen and the English translation of line 61 on the other. Bennett read it aloud. On Mount Gerizim, underneath the staircase of the upper tunnel, a chest and all its contents, and 60 talents of silver.
You're sure it's talking about the same mountain? He asked.
The spelling is different, Natasha noted, but yes, that's it.
So it could be those mountains where the treasure is buried? He pressed.
They all looked at each other with anticipation. They were onto something.
They could be, said Natasha. After all, if what we've got really is the key scroll, then whoever wrote it came up with a pretty ingenious code for keeping the treasure's secret.
Bennett wasn't sure he followed. Meaning?
Meaning it would take someone who has a tremendous knowledge and understanding of the Holy Scriptures to break this code, Natasha explained. They would have to be able to find this scroll. Then they'd have to be able to read it, which means they would have to be able to read Hebrew, and not many Romans could. Then they would have to know that the words in the scroll were actually Scripture. And even if they did realize that the text was Scripture, they would still have to figure out that each paragraph was a different portion of Scripture, and that certain phrases of those Scriptures were missing. Then they'd have to know where each portion of Scripture was found so they could accurately identify the missing phrases. And of course, they'd have to do it all without the aid of computers.
She was right, Bennett realized, and his anticipation began to grow. Chapter 53.
Saturday, January 17th, 10:20 a.m., the road to Boston.
Code in.
Sigma Delta Niner, Alpha 5 Sigma.
Stand by for authentication. Okay, go ahead, you are connected.
Vigo, we have a problem, said Indira Rajiv as she headed toward Boston.
No, we don't,
said Mariano.
We've got them.
What are you talking about? Asked Rajiv.
The Bennetts and the Barak girl, I'm telling you, we found them.
Where?
They're holed up in a house in Tiberias,
said Mariano.
We picked up their trail as they were coming out of the tunnel in the Golan Heights. My team and I followed them here. We've got them under surveillance. I just got off the phone with Farouk and Al-Hassani. They want me to camp out here until the Bennetts make their next move.
Golan. So her hunch had been correct. Did they find the key scroll? She asked.
They did,
Mariano confirmed.
They're decoding it now. We've got laser microphones trained on the windows. We're listening to everything they're saying.
Have they figured out where the treasures are yet? Asked Rajiv. Or the Ark?
No, not yet, but they seem to be getting close,
he assured her.
By the way, thanks for the tip. I still can't believe they actually asked you about Donovan and Harkin. The timing couldn't have been more perfect.
I know, said Rajiv. Once I got the email, I knew they were headed to the Golan. I didn't know exactly where, of course, but I guess you guys took care of that.
When do you think they'll contact you?
Mariano asked.
They may need your help again.
That may be a problem, said Rajiv.
Why?
I'm on the run.
What? What are you talking about?
They're onto me, Rajiv explained. The president found out yesterday morning that I'm one of only 7 people within our government who knew about Doron's temple project. He doesn't know it's me. None of them do. But it was only a matter of time.
How much time?
If I'd stayed, I'd have been in jail by nightfall.
Where are you now?
Trying to get out of the country.
Can you make it?
I think so, she said. I've got a decent head start. I left a message for my boss that I wasn't feeling well and was going to a doctor's appointment at noon. I said I'd be in some time in the afternoon.
But it's Saturday,
said Mariano. They don't care, said Rajiv. It's the CIA.
What about your husband?
He'll think I got home late, left early. Happens all the time. I left him a note reminding him to meet me at the Kennedy Center tonight for a concert. I'll leave him a message on his cell phone in a few hours. Tell him I love him. I doubt he'll be suspicious until nightfall.
You'd better be right,
said Mariano. Where do you want me? Asked Rajiv, changing the subject.
Head for Rome.
Why not Milan?
Rome is better. We'll have more assets there. I'll have someone meet you at the airport. Don't worry, we'll take care of everything. Do you have the files we asked for with you?
Of course.
Perfect.
But I want to meet him, said Rajiv.
What? Face to face?
Of course.
When?
By the end of the week.
No, that's impossible.
Do you want the files or don't you?
Of course we want them, but...
Then I want a meeting, face to face, just me and him.
And you'll get one, but not right now. Too much is happening, and we can't afford for you to be out in the open for long. Just get to Rome, and we'll make sure you're safe. I'll meet with you as soon as I can, probably a couple of days at most.
You didn't recruit me, said Rajiv defiantly. He did.
It doesn't matter. I'm running this operation, not him.
Don't play games with me, Vigo, Rajiv shot back. I know too much.
Are you threatening me?
He asked. You'd have nothing without me, and you know it. Now I want to see him before the week is out, alone. I don't care how you do it, just make it happen.
Chapter 54. Sunday, January 18th, 11:23 p.m., Tiberias, Israel. Natasha had been working around the clock. Exhausted and edgy, she had steered clear of both Bennetts for the last day or so as she continued trying to crack the code. But now she called them both to the kitchen.
Whoever wrote this stuff was absolutely brilliant, she said, her eyes weary and bloodshot,
when the Bennetts sat down with her at the table, where her computers, notebooks, maps, and Bibles were all spread out.
Obviously, they kept the Romans from ever finding the Copper Scroll. But even if the Romans had found it and deciphered it, they'd never have found the treasure. They'd have been on a wild goose chase. The treasure isn't buried in 63 different locations. It's only buried in one.
You're sure? Asked Bennett.
As sure as I can be, said Natasha. I've studied the scroll John found in the tunnel from every possible angle, and I am now convinced, beyond the shadow of a doubt, that it is the key scroll. This is the real thing.
Bennett breathed a sigh of relief and turned to Erin. Over the past several hours, her strength had been returning, and now a beautiful smile broke out across her face. What clinched it for you? He asked.
Pontius Pilate, Natasha replied.
The guy who condemned Jesus to die?
Exactly.
What are you talking about?
Do you know how Pilate left office? Natasha asked.
No, John and Erin admitted.
He was forced out. Why? Asked Erin. Because he ordered the slaughter of a group of Samaritans who believed a great treasure was buried on Mount Gerizim.
Really? Said Bennett. I've never heard that.
Josephus tells the story in The Antiquities of the Jews, Natasha explained. Look, I'll show you.
She pulled up a website with the complete works of Josephus and did a search for Pilate. A moment later, she found Book 18, Chapter 4, Section 1.
But the nation of the Samaritans did not escape without tumults. The man who excited them to it was one who thought lying a thing of little consequence, and who contrived everything so that the multitude might be pleased. So he bade them get together upon Mount Gerizim, which is by them looked upon as the most holy of all mountains, and assured them that, when they were come thither, he would show them those sacred vessels which were laid under that place, because Moses put them there. So they came thither, armed, but Pilate prevented their going up by seizing upon the roads with a great band of horsemen and footmen, and Pilate ordered them to be slain.
Natasha went on to read about how Pilate was reprimanded by his superiors for the massacre and forced to leave his post in Jerusalem.
Then she said, Moses never crossed the Jordan, so obviously he could never have buried those sacred vessels on Mount Gerizim. But what's interesting about Josephus's account is how strong the tradition was in the region, that temple treasures, perhaps even including the Ark, were buried on that mountain. And if that weren't enough, there are still some 600 or so Samaritans living in Israel today, and they are convinced that the Messiah will come one day and show them where that great treasure is buried on Mount Gerizim.
They were getting closer.
That's the good news, said Natasha. Now the bad news.
Confused, John and Erin followed Natasha as she abruptly left the kitchen and sat down on the balcony, staring out across the Sea of Galilee as storm clouds gathered over the Golan Heights in the distance.
What bad news? Erin asked, taking a seat on one of the cushioned lounge chairs and wrapping herself with a wool blanket. Gerizim was the site of a Samaritan temple, a temple long considered heretical by the Jews, said Natasha. What's more, at the time the Copper Scroll and the Key Scroll were written and hidden, Mount Gerizim was the site of a Roman military stronghold as well as a major Roman palace. The ruins are still there today.
And?
Well, why would the Jews risk burying the entire temple treasures so close to their worst enemy? It doesn't fit.
What about Mount Ebal? Bennett asked.
Natasha sighed. The problem there is that the scriptures refer to Mount Ebal as a mountain of curses. It seems unlikely that the Jews who wrote this scroll would hide the temple treasures in a mountain of curses.
It was quiet for a few minutes, save for the sound of some birds flying over the sea. Bennett leaned back and watched the storm moving in. Erin, meanwhile, pulled out her Bible and began studying it carefully.
Natasha, with all due respect, I think you might be mistaken about Mount Ebal, she said a few minutes later. How so? Well, look, you're the expert in all these archaeology matters, and I don't pretend to understand it all, certainly not like you do, Erin said as diplomatically as she could. But I'm in a women's Bible study back in Washington, and we've been studying the book of Joshua. And if I remember correctly, Mount Ebal itself was never cursed.
Go on, said Natasha, obviously curious.
Well, from what I understand, and again, I realize you've got a lot more training and experience than I do, the scriptures simply say that Mount Ebal is the location where the Hebrews were supposed to explain God's curses on those who disobey. It doesn't actually say the mountain itself is cursed. Where are you getting this from? Asked Natasha. Joshua chapter 8, verses 30 to 34. Should I read it out loud?
Absolutely, said Bennett.
Then Joshua built on Mount Ebal an altar to the Lord, the God of Israel, as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded the Israelites. He built it according to what is written in the book of the law of Moses, an altar of uncut stones on which no iron tool had been used. On it they offered to the Lord burnt offerings and sacrificed fellowship offerings. There, in the presence of the Israelites, Joshua copied on stones the law of Moses, which he had written. All Israel, aliens and citizens alike, were standing on both sides of the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, facing those who carried it, the priests, who were Levites. Half of the people stood in front of Mount Gerizim, and half of them in front of Mount Ebal, as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had formerly commanded when he gave instructions to bless the people of Israel. Afterward, Joshua read all the words of the law, the blessings and the curses, just as it is written in the book of the law. "Did the Romans ever have a fortress or palace on Mount Ebal?" asked Aaron.
Natasha shook her head.
"Not that I'm aware of," she said. "Why?" "Humor me for a moment," Aaron replied, "but I'm just thinking, if Mount Ebal were really cursed, why would Joshua have built an altar there? Why would he have offered sacrifices to God there, or chiseled the word of God into stone on Mount Ebal?"
Natasha didn't reply.
"He wouldn't have," Aaron continued, "which means Mount Ebal couldn't have been cursed."
"Where are you going with this?" Bennett asked.
"I'm just saying, what if the author of the Copper Scroll mentioned Gerizim to throw people off track, knowing full well that the Samaritans had a temple there and that the Romans had a fortress there? What if that's why no one's ever found anything in the caves of Gerizim, because the treasure was actually buried on Mount Ebal instead?"
Chapter 55. Monday, January 17th, 8 p.m., Babylon, Iraq. The press conference began promptly at noon Eastern Standard Time. Halfway around the world, Iraqi President al-Hassani watched with great interest.
"Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon and thank you for coming," began
UN Secretary General Luis Pipilo.
"As you know, I did not seek a second term. Indeed, I had hoped to step out of this job on January 1st and turn over the reins of this great institution to the President of South Africa. President Mugabe has been in the hospital for the past few weeks, and I have stayed on in an interim capacity until he could assume his duties here. Sadly, I must inform you that President Mugabe has just been diagnosed with inoperable cancer, and he believes that he will not be able to serve as he had hoped. He has therefore asked me to help find someone who will bring the necessary energy and passion to the job. After careful consideration, it is my great pleasure to nominate Dr. Salvador Ciro Lucente."
200 flashes and auto advancers went off as cameramen captured the moment. It was being hailed as breaking news on television networks around the world, but it was old news to al-Hassani, and he studied the scene carefully, waiting for a signal that his fate and Lucente's were now inextricably linked.
"Dr. Lucente is not simply exceptionally well qualified for this position," the Secretary General continued. "In so many ways, his life represents the vision of the UN. He was born in Barcelona on June 6, 1942, to parents who came from two different countries, two different languages, two different ethnic backgrounds. His father, Ciro Lucente, was born and raised just outside of Rome. His mother, Juanita, was born in Madrid. But when they met in the spring of 1940, they did not let their differences stand between them. They were married 6 weeks from the day they met. When the war was over, young Salvador went to school in Spain and summered in Sicily. He went on to graduate from the University of Barcelona and from Harvard. He worked for AT&T and then started his own company."
Al-Hassani lit his pipe. He had the Foreign Minister of India waiting to see him, followed by another 6 hours of meetings with various leaders from what was left of Syria, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and the several Central Asian republics. So far, everything was on schedule. Terms were being negotiated, deals were being cut. He hoped to have his own announcement to make to the world soon, but so much depended upon Lucente.
"And, of course, for the last several years, he has served ably as the European Union Foreign Minister, where he has helped improve relations between India and Pakistan, assisted in diffusing tensions between North and South Korea, and helped manage the crisis we had between Russia and Israel last year. Personally, I cannot think of a better man to lead the United Nations in this critical hour, and it is my hope... Enough, thought Al-Hassani. Let the man speak.
Several minutes later, Lucente finally took his place behind the podium and the bank of microphones.
What a tremendous honor to be considered for this position, he began. It is one that I take very seriously, and should I be acceptable to the nations of this esteemed body, I will do everything in my power to continue the important structural and institutional reforms Secretary General Pepillo has begun to implement, and to bring peace and prosperity to the developing nations of our world. Out of respect for the process, I will not take any questions until I have had the opportunity to meet personally with each representative on the Security Council. I promise, however, to hold a press conference very soon so I can answer your questions, of which I'm sure there are many. That said, I do want to say that my top two priorities as Secretary General would be, number one, to accelerate both the relief and reconstruction efforts in those countries devastated by the firestorm and earthquake of a few months ago, and number two, to get oil flowing out of the Middle East once again, so we can bring down prices and reinvigorate the global economy. Neither of these tasks will be easy, of course. They will require an enormous degree of cooperation, particularly with countries such as Israel and Iraq. As you know, I have just come from meetings with leaders in both countries, and I can tell you that both Prime Minister Daron and President Al-Hassani have personally assured me that they will do everything possible to reduce tensions in the region and get Middle Eastern oil back on the market. Indeed, to that end, I hope to have a major announcement for you very shortly. Thank you all very much.
Chapter 56. Monday, January 19th, 8:36 p.m., Tiberias, Israel. The three of them pored over every map they could find. Mount Ebal was south of them, about halfway between Tiberias and Jerusalem, not far from the Palestinian town of Nablus, known in ancient times as Shechem. Yet according to Natasha, very few serious archaeological excavations had ever been done there. Most scholars focused on the Roman and Samaritan ruins on Gerizim. Thus, the kind of access roads found on Gerizim simply didn't exist on Ebal. What's more, they had neither the time nor the manpower to scour the entire mountain. One wrong move could mean being arrested by Israeli forces or shot by one of Farouk's men. Bennett turned to his wife. What do you think?
With what we've got? She asked. I don't think we'll make it. We don't even know where to start.
Any suggestions?
We need satellite photos, said Aaron, plain and simple. Those maps simply aren't good enough. We need to study every nook and cranny of the mountain, look for cave openings, do thermal imaging, hunt for underground tunnels, that kind of thing.
What about Rajiv? Bennett suggested. She helped us before. Maybe you could call her again.
Who's Rajiv? Asked Natasha. A friend of mine at CIA, said Aaron. She's the one who helped us get into Mordecai's house the other night.
So what do you think? Asked Bennett. Aaron looked uneasy.
To do it, she'd have to retask the satellite again.
She did it once for you.
I know, but I can't ask her again. It wouldn't be fair to her.
You really think she'd turn us in?
No, but it's not just her. Claire, at the National Recon Office... Bobby at NGA, maybe a few more, would have to be involved. We'd be putting Rajiv in a terrible position. She could lose her job. She could go to prison.
Bennett sighed. It's not like our cup of options runneth over, he noted. Call her. The worst that can happen is she'll say no. Mariano called with another update. Al-Hassani said goodbye to the Indian foreign minister and took the secure call.
We've had a complication.
Mariano began.
Don't tell me you lost them, said Al-Hassani.
No, no, it's Daron,
said Mariano.
He's appointed a government commission to finalize a design for the third temple.
Tell me you're joking.
I wish I were,
said Mariano.
But the news just broke here, and Farouk is going nuts. I'm telling you, he's lost it, Your Excellency. He just called to say he wants me to kill the Bennets, take the Barak girl hostage, and force her to lead us to the Ark. And if I don't do it, he'll find someone who will.
The fool, snapped Al-Hassani. He'll ruin everything. I don't want them touched until we see how far they can take us, or unless they turn themselves in.
But Farouk is threatening to pull his money, said Mariano.
I don't need his money, Al-Hassani fumed. I don't need him at all.
This was his idea,
Mariano recalled,
and he has gotten us this far.
And he's becoming a liability. Where is he now?
In a house outside of Amman, sir.
You know what to do, Vigo, Al-Hassani said calmly. Just make it look like a suicide.
Rajiv isn't answering.
Did you try your cell phone? Bennett asked.
Twice, said Aaron. All I got was voicemail.
Bennett glanced out the window. It was already dark. If they were going to move, it would have to be soon. Any suggestions? He asked, not expecting any.
Actually, one, said Aaron.
What is it?
Come here,
she said as she logged onto the internet and went to earth.google.com.
What is that? Asked Natasha.
Open-source satellite imagery. I'll need to download the software and install it, but it's free and it might just help, Aaron said.
Moments later, the download was complete. Aaron quickly executed the installation procedures and launched the application.
What is this going to do for us exactly? Natasha asked.
Aaron clicked on More Information, which Natasha read aloud.
Point and zoom to any place on the planet that you want to explore. Satellite images and local facts zoom into view. Tap into Google search to show local points of interest and facts. Zoom to a specific address to check out an apartment or hotel. View driving directions and even fly along your route.
On the screen, a star field appeared with a small image of planet Earth in the center, as seen from 39,189.76 miles up. Next, Aaron typed in Tiberias, Israel. Instantly, the computer began to take them on a guided flight from outer space to a remarkably clear view of the seaside city from 13,044 feet up. The image was all blurry until she hit Control-F6, followed by a cheat code she'd learned from her days at Langley. This enabled her to bypass the scrambling software that Israel had demanded Google include, so enemies of the Jewish state couldn't use the site to target missile or bomber strikes. Suddenly, the topography was crystal clear.
That's incredible, Natasha marveled.
What street are we on again? Asked Aaron.
Ihad Ha'am Street, said Natasha.
Aaron clicked a small icon called Roads, and suddenly bright red lines marked every road in and around Tiberias, small and large, showing street names in bright white letters. She found the right street, manipulated the controls a bit further, and they were zooming in to 5,000 feet, then 1,000 feet, then just a few hundred feet, until they were looking through the kitchen windows of the very house they were sitting in.
Pretty cool, huh?
Natasha gasped. It's amazing. If I walk out on the balcony, will you be able to see me?
Aaron laughed.
Sorry, it's not real time, but the resolution is actually quite extraordinary for a non-military satellite.
I'll say, said Natasha, examining the picture more closely.
And check this out, said Aaron. You can rotate it to see the other side of the house as well.
Look, you can even read the number on the front door, said Natasha.
Can you pull up Mount Ebal? Said Bennett, checking his watch again.
Absolutely, said Aaron. That's where I'm headed.
She zoomed out for a moment, panned southward to Nablus, and found the distinctive slopes of Mount Ebal. For the next 20 minutes, the three of them scoured every square inch of the Mountain of Curses. Sure enough, there were no roads of any kind, but they did find 9 cave openings, 6 on the south and east fronts, 1 on the north side, and 2 on the west.
So, what should we do? Asked Aaron. We don't have time to explore all 9. We barely have time to explore 1. And we need to get moving if we've got any prayer of getting something done tonight, said Natasha.
Aaron turned to her husband.
Want to just pick one at random?
But Bennett was chewing on something.
What was that verse again? The one that begins, as you know? Deuteronomy, chapter 11, verse 30, said Natasha. Can you look it up again?
What are you thinking?
I'm not sure, but...
His voice trailed off. Natasha found the verse and began reading it aloud.
As you know, these mountains are across the Jordan, west of the road, toward the setting sun, near the giant trees of...
There. That's it, said Bennett, apologizing for cutting her off. West of the road, that's what we're looking for. Caves on the west side. I know it's thin, but it's the only geographic reference in the whole scroll. I say we go with it and pray for mercy.
Chapter 57. Monday, January 17th, 9:48 p.m., Tiberias, Israel.
They're moving.
Mariano realized he had drifted off.
Who's moving? He asked, trying to shake off his fatigue.
The Bennetts and the Barak girl.
When?
They just pulled out. Rossetti's got two vehicles following them. We've got another car waiting for you.
Have they got radios?